This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?"
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And this is Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman. Hello.
Welcome back to another episode of Seriously.
So last week we talked about Fleabag.
Our favourite show, Fleabag.
Our favourite show of the year so far, I would
say. I think it is fast becoming like my big thing of the year.
On BBC Three, if you didn't see it, most of it is still on iPlayer.
Yeah, it's on iPlayer for 5 months.
Oh, fantastic. So yeah, do all go and catch that.
I think the final episode is out this week.
Ah, fantastic. So we've had an email from Amy about it. She says, "I didn't realise this was now a BBC Three sitcom. I was lucky enough to see this as a one-woman show back in January 2015. It was pure brilliance, laugh-out-loud hilarious, touching and honest, and yes, majorly cringeworthy. Worked really, really well in the intimate confessional one-hander format, and me and my friend loitered unashamedly afterwards to make Phoebe drink with us. Sadly in vain, but that was the vibe of the show."
I can imagine it was the vibe of the show.
Which is really interesting. So you interviewed Phoebe Waller-Bridge just recently, didn't you?
Yeah, I found her like such a delight to talk to. And I think she also did a little Q&A for The Big Issue recently where they asked her about karaoke, all these different questions about karaoke. And she had all these fun stories about how she like dragged her husband to karaoke on one of their first dates and how Olivia Colman is a secret, like, amazing karaoke person.
I can totally see that. I really like the Olivia Colman anecdotes in your interview as well.
Yeah.
Like how they were in a play together a few years ago or something. And Olivia Colman was like, "Yeah, you know, I'm interested in your stuff. So like, if you ever have anything that you think I'd be good for, do get in touch." So then what Phoebe Waller-Bridge writes for her is the creepy stepmother in Fleabag. And Olivia Colman's like, "Yes, I will do that."
Yeah, Phoebe kept using the word naughty, and she said that was a really naughty role. And I think that's such a good way to describe it. So yeah, she's really fun, and I found her like a complete delight to talk to. And she was very good at like switching between talking about, you know, something really, really bleak and depressing and then just like laughing it off with a little joke, which is obviously the sort of vibe that you get watching Fleabag, which continues to get sadder and sadder.
It does indeed. I have now watched all of it, and same. I'm still thinking about it. It's so dark by the end, but so completely compelling that, yeah, I can't even compare the reaction I've had to it to anything else I've seen this year.
Yeah, and when I finished watching the last episode, which I won't describe for anyone because you really do just have to go into it blind, but when I finished watching it, I watched it again immediately
from
the beginning because I was just like, oh my god, that was so good. And I was just sobbing and had to repeat it again. There were 3 monologues in that whole series that I just thought were amazing. So the one with Hugh Dennis that I think we touched upon when we were talking about it.
Hugh Dennis, the man from Mock the Week, give me such feels.
Exactly. And then there's one from Fleabag right at the end that is really gutting. And there's a great one from Olivia Colman as well, where she's at an art exhibition of her own work that is just one of the most cutting and powerful monologues, basically about power in your relationships and sex. And yeah, so, so good. So I'd love to see her doing more stuff. And she did sort of hint to me at the end of her interview that she had some exciting projects coming up.
Oh, that's
so
good.
I can't wait to see what she does next.
Yeah, so we'll link to Anna's interview with her in the show notes so you can go check that out. But we can't recommend it highly enough, really. This is an unusual double recommend from us. We talked about it last episode. We're talking about it again.
I'm sure we will end up, if we do our best things of the year at the end of the year like we did last year.
Yeah, we'll, you will hear more about it. No doubt about it.
So the thing that we're going to be talking about first this week is a new album from Frank Ocean. So Frank Ocean blessed the world with his first studio album, Channel Orange, all the way back in 2012. It was a critical and popular success, and since then, many have been waiting and waiting for his next release. Then this weekend, Ocean released three new works at once, a so-called visual album titled Endless, which streamed on Apple Music, a zine called Boys Don't Cry, and his second studio album, Blonde. So it's a real jumble of different things. I think the most exciting part of the weekend for a lot of people was when they realised that Frank Ocean had set up these sort of pop-up shops in random newsagents in four different cities. So there was one near the British Library. I was already asleep when this was announced at sort of 1 or 1.30. So that was my kind of Saturday night. But people who were still up and out doing things all went to this random newsagent by the British Library, and there were all these amazing magazines that contained a copy of the album, but also like a poem by Frank Ocean. There was a little poem by Kanye West in there about McDonald's. There's pictures of cars, apparently. And all this sort of weird stuff. Before that, we'd had the sort of the visual stream of Frank Ocean, like, building a staircase out of some wood set to a few new tracks. And then the actual sort of big mainstream album release came finally at the end of the weekend. And I spent a rather lazy Sunday sort of listening to it and napping, which I quite enjoyed.
Yeah, and I was going to say, that is very much the kind of feeling of the album. It's quite trippy and heady, I found. Blonde,
like hazy,
I mean.
Yeah.
It's got quite a lot of synthy organ and modified vocals that are quite ethereal and that kind of thing on it. So it does feel, I mean, maybe this is a bit of a stretch, but a little bit Bjorky, actually.
I find that it's that weird line between, so Channel Orange, when it came out, I went on a holiday with my dad to Spain and I listened to it like the entire time on repeat. And for me, a lot of Frank Ocean's work straddles that line between being like really good, you're lying on the sun lounge, you're relaxing by the pool vibe, but it can tip over into you like staring at the sky, like wondering what the point of it all is and why you're even on this planet. So it's sort of like a nice holiday relax until it like pushes you over the edge and you're like, fuck man, what am I doing on this little planet? I found this album like very emotional. It's like very, very soulful. There are points in this album where you feel like maybe he's taking the piss out of you almost, because he'll come in with like a random, like vulgar lyric, but he'll do it in such a way that it still feels very poignant and still feels emotional. There's a line in this where he says, if you still need dick, then I got you. But it's done in such a way that just makes you think about all those sort of weird, intimate, tangential relationships you've had with people that are not very easily definable, but are still some sort of support.
There's a bit in, it's one of the songs early on, Blonde.
Yeah, Nikes. Yeah.
Like Nikes, where he says, Trayvon, he looked like me.
Yeah.
Which,
that's a real punch in the
gut
moment.
When I first time I heard that, I was like, oh god, which is obviously a reference to Trayvon Martin, shot by police and become a kind of really iconic figure in the Black Lives Matter movement in the US and all that kind of stuff.
I also found that on Solo, where you get these sort of police sirens almost, these like very abstract noises, but they do make you think of police sirens coming in. And then the Andre 3000 verse that's like amazing and super fast, that also references some police brutality issues. But I think the overriding themes of his work, I think probably in the same way as Channel Orange, are a bit more existential and a bit more to do with like loneliness and purpose. And they're very big, complicated, abstract, vague things that are hard to pin down. And I think for me, I'm going to struggle to really articulate. I would never be able to be like, this is what this album is about.
The other thing that I found with it as well is that despite the fact of how hugely anticipated it is, I mean, like waiting for Frank Ocean has long been a meme, it's still, the first time I listened to it, I still felt like he was talking to me.
Even though you know that this album has been 4 years in the making, it doesn't feel overproduced. There's still a real colloquial tone, because he can do this sort of style of music that's between singing and rapping and talking and is something else at points.
I read a quote from him describing his own singing style once, where he said he was a baritone with tenor moments.
Which, that's nice.
It was a really good description that I was kind of looking for, because I like to analyse singers' voices specifically and quite technically sometimes when I like their music. And I was like, yeah, his range is weirdly,
he's got that amazing falsetto, yeah. But he actually uses it very sparingly, yeah. Because I think he's very well known for it.
It surprises you when it comes in.
Yeah. And after Thinking About You, I think he's you almost expect that falsetto from him. But in Blonde especially, it's really only used at like the most key moments.
And he keeps quite a lot of the rest of it in a low register,
mm-hmm.
which can sound a little bit more spoken and like definite and emphatic.
It's interesting that I like that phrase, the baritone with tenor moments, especially because there's so much, there've been a lot of speculation about like gender and sexuality and the portrayal of masculinity that goes on in Frank Ocean's work. I guess because he did this Tumblr post after Channel Orange was released where he said that his first love was a man. Mm. And I think that's basically all he's said about his sexuality.
Yeah, I'm not
and
aware he, of saying any more.
Yeah, and he sings two women and two men on his albums. Yeah. But that's, as you say, it's kicked off a lot of speculation about that element of his sort of stage persona, as it were. And then with Blonde, you get an album that its title uses one of the very few words in English that is still gendered. And on the cover, it's Blonde without an E. And on the title, when you download the album on your iTunes or whatever, that it's Blonde with an E. So he's obviously intentionally playing with that idea. So I like the idea that he was like, yeah, I'm a baritone with tenor moments. I contain all these multitudes. And he does say in the Boys Don't Cry zine, when he's talking about his fixation with cars, he's like, someone said to me that maybe it's a straight boy fantasy of mine to be into cars, but actually I'm just accepting that it's all good. Like, I can have all this stuff at once, which is great. I love that about him.
I love how big he is on Tumblr, incidentally.
Yeah, he's like a Tumblr persona, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. He does his own Tumblr as well. I'm going to very confidently say that is not stage managed.
I found it really interesting how the delay surrounding the album has, like, between people I follow on Twitter, certainly anyway, sparked a lot of conversation about, like, how everything is rushed. It obviously does become quite a lot of pressure for those artists to have people constantly being like, where's the album, where's the album? And he does say in his... in his album notes, like, thanks for all of you. He's made me realise that I had to finish this, which was literally every single one of you, haha. I loved that so much, the little haha at the end.
But there is something to the fact that, and I suppose you can think of Frank Ocean on one side and Kanye West on the other, really, that because you can just upload an album and everyone can download it within seconds, and then seconds later, it seems like, have their thoughts on it.
Mm.
When it can all be so instantaneous, surely, like, hovering on the precipice of, like, clicking upload must feel absolutely awful.
Yeah. Yeah, whereas someone like Kanye, who's just like, yeah, have some more, have some more.
Yeah, exactly. And he's like, oh, I did a different version. Oh, wait, no, now it's a fashion show. Oh, also this. Whereas Frank Ocean has clearly just been, like, sitting in front of the computer being like, not yet. Not yet, Apple Music. I will not click go yet.
Well, I found it completely worth the wait, and I'm excited to keep listening to it. And I'm going to take it away with me on holiday, and I think that'll be really nice.
Yeah. Now we're going to talk about Swallows and Amazons in the new film adaptation of Arthur Ransom's novel from 1930 of the same name. It follows the adventures of the Walker children as they go sailing in the Lake District on their summer holidays and discover pirates, spies, and much more besides. Among the adult cast, you see Jessica Hines, Rafe Spall, Harry Enfield, and Sherlock's Andrew Scott, i.e. Moriarty.
I hereby name this Walker Island and claim it for our own.
The Amazons?
What does this mean?
The Jolly Roger. That's their sign.
Who are you?
I'm Nancy Blackett, part owner of the Amazon. Give us back our island.
Not frightened, are you?
Or the pirate who sent you.
She means Uncle Jim.
Shut up, you donkey.
This is a classic Caroline movie, I feel.
I would dispute that because I don't think this movie is very good.
Well, I think the topic in general of kids having a great time sailing is something that I can imagine absolutely captured your imagination as a
book,
child.
The book is a very important book to me.
Yeah.
And the book is really good and very interesting. Actually, I've reread it as an adult and there are lots of like things in it that you don't see when you're a child. But I don't think this is a very good film adaptation of that book because none of that stuff is in there.
In your mind, what are the major things this film gets wrong about the book?
In the broadest sense, it doesn't look like the Lake District, because it is not the Lake District.
Oh, I didn't even realise. I've never been to the Lake District.
They filmed it, most of it, in Yorkshire.
Right.
And there's quite a lot of CGI involved, which means that the lake looks really empty. There's no one else on it. There's no, like, houses round it. Whereas the Lake District in 1930 and the Lake District today is full of people having fun on the water, people working on the land, people doing stuff. And the book is really into that. Like, they're always meeting people or, like, trying to get out of people's way or worried that they're, you know, going to cause accidents or whatever. And it's a big part of how the, like, tension in the book happens.
That also changes how unsafe it feels like the children are, because if they're a part of the danger in the book is that they're going to, like, drown and no one's going to be around to save them.
Yeah, exactly. And this film has apparently been in development for a really long time. I found an interview from 2011 where someone from BBC Films was saying how they'd taken the decision not to, like, update the book and make the children wear life jackets and any of the, like, safety stuff you would now do if you were allowing young teenagers to go sailing on their own on a lake and camp on an island and all this kind of stuff. They decided not to do that. Although they did update one of the children's names.
Is her name Titty, I hear?
Yes.
Titty.
They made it Tatty in the
Tatty
book.
Is not a name, though, is it?
No, I know. Which kind of made me sad. And I also feel like they've been quite selective with that kind of update. So they update that, but they don't update the fact that the other kids are wearing, like, red Indian headdresses.
Yeah, or that there's, like, not a single face of colour anywhere to be seen.
So I sort of feel like either...
You can't have it both ways.
Yeah, either we're going with the, like, 1930s take on everything.
Jolly hockey sticks, titties galore.
Yeah, or we're not. Or it's a story for 2016 kind of thing. So that was, I felt, a bit weird.
Mm-hmm.
It also doesn't help that there's a really good TV version from 1973.
Right.
Which far outstrips everything I saw in this one.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that, like, this one didn't have any of the songs in it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, exactly. And it didn't have any of their, like, cod interpretation of the popular culture of the time. And it's actually Titty who has all of these thoughts, because she's, like, the voracious reader, and she was the one I very much, like, saw myself standing in for when I read the books. And, you know, when they first climb up on the hill and see the lake when they first arrived, she does a really bad quotation of, you know, the Keats poem where they looked at each other with a wild surmise, silent on a peak in Darien, you know, like Columbus first seeing the ocean, you know, that kind of stuff. They took all of that out and, like, all the bad quotations and the funny songs are all gone.
Yeah, so you felt the spirit of it was sort of missing in
that sense. And I felt like they'd made it a bit too generic northern. So, like, none of the accents of any of the adults bore any relation to what Cumbria actually sounds like.
Yeah.
Harry Enfield played a very one-dimensional, kind of like, I'm a grumpy man.
I had a real issue with some of the casting there. You know, I just approached this like a film because I've not read the book. And I found it, the Harry Enfield, Jessica Hines couple thing. I'm sorry. How old is Jessica Hines?
I know. It's so
I actually want to look it up because, like, that was so, so frustrating. Harry Enfield's playing, like, a practically on death's door old father, and then 43-year-old Jessica Hines is his, like, world-weary wife, and it just made me, like, so annoyed. She's already slipped into those basically granny-ish roles. So annoying.
Yeah, that was really frustrating, actually. Also, their characters, because they play the family whose farm it is that the Walker children and their mum are staying at. And in the book, they're quite well-rounded characters. They're in lots of the subsequent sequels. Like, they have relationships with the children. Like, you know, they actually are people that you feel like you know. And in this, they were just, like, the one joke where Harry Enfield would mutter something and Jessica Hines would be like, oh.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah, it's so annoying.
So I generally felt like the worst dynamics of the original book, i.e. the fact that it's, like, the posh children coming from London to have their holidays in the Lake District, were amplified in this film. Because at least in the book, they are posh children coming from elsewhere, but they're so interested and curious about the landscape and the people who work there that you kind of forgive them for their outsider-ish ignorance. Particularly because the Blacketts, the two girls that they make friends with, are from there. And, like, introduce them to the ways of the place. And, like, they really come to love the place and the landscape for what it is rather than what they imagine it should be. All we got in the film was posh children sailing.
Yeah. But there was another element to this film which I heartily enjoyed.
Yes.
Which is, there's a spy plot line which I hear is not in the original story at all.
No, it's nothing to do that at all. So if you haven't read Swallows and Amazons or seen it and don't want to be spoiled, you know, duck out now. But in the film. I'm not quite sure why. I guess maybe to give it a kind of more definite narrative arc or something, they inserted this idea that the Blackett girls, Nancy and Peggy, their uncle is a kind of grumpy man with a houseboat. That much is in the book.
And a parrot on his shoulder. Is that in the book as well?
Yes, he's got a parrot. So
there is this sort of pirate figure.
Yeah, so they like to pretend that he's a pirate. And also he's really grumpy and doesn't want to spend any time with his nieces or their friends. So he kind of stays holed up in his boat. In the book, this is because he is writing a book. He is writing a memoir. And that's why he doesn't want to play with them. And then there's a burglary on his houseboat and his book manuscript is stolen and the children help recover it. And then he realises that actually they were just trying to have fun with him and they weren't trying to piss him off and mm-hmm. like, all's well that ends well. Mm-hmm. In the film,
that's a facade.
Yeah.
The fact that he's a writer to cover up the fact that he's actually an international spy.
He's like a Cold War spy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which is crazy, but I found really fun.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, like Andrew Scott of Moriarty fame reprises effectively his role as Moriarty in this.
Yeah, love it. I sat next to him in the theatre once and was like, ooh, Moriarty.
As a kind of Russian spy hunter.
Yeah.
And
it's absurd and very, very silly because apparently international secrecy could be thwarted by like two kids with a little boat and some rope. Yeah. But it's still sort of entertaining.
Yeah, and I agree that having sat in a grump all the way through this film about the things I've mentioned, that plot line was kind of the best thing about it in the sense that I really enjoyed the whole like action sequence with the seaplane. I really enjoyed Andrew Scott switching between his like posh Moriarty voice and his Russian accent.
Yeah, I just found his whole performance really funny where he would like be sat in a corner and you didn't notice him and being just like obscenely horrible to children for no reason, like all of that stuff. Really fun.
I enjoyed how he and his like Russian mate were obviously not enjoying being in the Lake District at all mm-hmm. and kept complaining about how cold it was and how they kept getting rained on and stuff. And yeah, that was really amusing. But as I say, that's really nothing to do with Wallace and Amazons. You could have a whole separate film
just
of
made
that.
They should have maybe just made a really fun spy movie.
Yeah, like the adventures of like, I don't know, Boris and Stefan.
yeah, I would watch that for sure. So, you know, filmmakers, maybe just get me and Caroline in the old writer's room.
Yeah, we'll totally write that for you. Because this is only the second film adaptation of Swallows and Amazons, despite it being...
The first is the TV one.
It was like a for TV film, I think, which I had on a VHS when I was a child, and my sister and I watched it constantly.
Oh.
There was a musical of it that the National Theatre did a few years ago.
I bet that was quite good.
That was quite good. With songs by my favourite, Neil Hannon of the Divine Comedy.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. So that was, obviously they couldn't do any of the sailing stuff, or they did it with like tiny boats behind a screen, like shadow puppets, but there was lots more of the like songs and general jollity, and it just had more of that kind of make do and mend,
yeah,
like scratching a childhood out of wartime type vibe. Yeah, did you warm to any of the children in this?
They were very cute and very Aryan children.
Mm.
There was something about it that I was a bit like, I'm not going to be able to articulate it very well, but I was like, wow, this is a real like vision of like blonde white Britishness with these children. They just looked absolutely perfect. And the boys were both very adorable and the girls were both like, you know, picture perfect. So they're kind of irresistibly cute in that sense. But I just felt a bit like weird about it. And also they didn't have like enormous personalities. The youngest kid,
Roger,
he had the biggest laugh in my screening, which was mostly old people, not any actual children, when someone says, look, it's the Jolly Roger. And Roger goes, I don't feel very jolly. Enormous laugh in the Chelsea Cineworld. I'm not sure, really. I liked the girls. Overwhelmingly, I felt like I was watching a story of like blonde, entitled, posh, Aryan children invading an island run by powerful women and imposing their European patriarchal systems upon the island. And so I was really rooting for the Blackets, I found, rather than the Walkers.
Yeah, so that's what I mean by the fact that the film amplified like the worst aspects of the book. Because in the book, they do that a bit, but then they kind of like talk it out and everyone learns a bit and it's like, oh, we probably shouldn't have done that. Oh, well, you're welcome. Let's be friends. Like, there wasn't really that kind of mitigating sense of accommodation.
Rather than these blonde kids like soaring in with their brand new boat going, this is Walker Island now, I name it after myself. Who are these Amazons?
They
get
don't
out.
Call it that in the book. They call it Wildcat Island because they think it sounds like cool and strange.
Yeah.
You know, so I feel like the book was quite badly served by this film.
Well, there we go. I think we're going to all have to go and watch this 70s TV film.
It's all on YouTube. So last week, I recommended that Anna have a go at the BBC TV series All Creatures Great and Small from the late 70s, I believe. Anna, what did you make of it?
I was just thinking when we were talking about swallows and Amazons that there's actually some thematic crossover here, right? About like the kind of posh southern person arriving in the northern town and not really knowing any of the slang, but being so taken with the landscape and the people that they just try their hardest to like fit in, which is basically what's going on in this TV series from what I can tell from the bits that I've watched.
So the central character, Jim, is actually supposed to be from Edinburgh.
Oh, right.
But I think he's
definitely not got an Edinburgh accent in the show.
But I think in the memoirs that the series is based on, you kind of get the sense that, you know, he's like a kind of posh Scot. So he has, presumably in real life, that kind of soft Scottish accent that can sound quite quickly London-y if it's around other London people kind of thing. But yeah, in the TV series, the actor who plays him just does it with RP.
So he's a recently qualified vet and he comes to this town because there's a potential for him to get a job as like the apprentice of the like village vet or town vet. And he arrives there and the actual vet is nowhere to be seen. So he's sort of making a go of basically being the apprentice temporarily while this guy is sort of off doing a job or something. And this guy comes to the door, and this bit did make me laugh quite a lot, where he's describing to him all the ailments that his cow is suffering from. But he does it using all this regional language that the new guy is just like completely. And he's saying stuff like, she's only firing from two cylinders, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, I don't actually know if he's talking about a cow at all. I don't know what's going on. So he just like repeats it basically verbatim to the vet once he actually turns up. And then, you know, you realise that cylinder means bit of udder and all these other, you know, slang terms. But he's basically just trying to, like, find his feet without knowing the sort of customs and norms of his surroundings. So that's where a lot of the humour comes from, basically. This, like, very straight, tweedy guy, like, rubbing up against all these real characters. Which is, yeah, it's funny, definitely.
Yeah, and it's quite comforting, I find. Because as a show, the way it's structured is there's normally, like, two or three different animal cases per episode. And
It really goes for it with the animal cases, by the way. Like, you see a lot of bits of animals. Like, I definitely saw a man pull his arm out of the arse of a horse on this programme. Like, stuff that I don't think they would put on telly in that much detail now.
They actually had to do that as well. Like, the actors actually did it. Because, you know, that's what a real vet does if it
like
needs
to, like, a shit slick arm. Like, you don't normally see that before the watershed.
Yeah, they definitely do that. And so you'll normally get like a sort of slightly tragic farm case, you'll get like a slightly funny one, and then you'll get a kind of ongoing update on like someone we've been following for a while sort of thing. And then around that you get the personal stories of the three guys really who live in the vet practice. Jim, the apprentice, Siegfried, who's the kind of...
Booming is how I describe booming. Him.
Yes, that's how the book describes him, I think. He booms. Siegfried, who's like the head of the practice. And then, I don't know if you've met him in the ones that you've watched so far, Siegfried's brother, Tristan, who's still at veterinary college.
No, he's been mentioned several times as arriving soon.
Yeah, so he drops in every so often because he's still at college and therefore only gets the holidays off. And when he's there, they use him as like... unqualified free labor. So he does a lot of like doing all the bills and like having to look after the pigs and doing the like boring easy jobs that he can be trusted with. But he's kind of a bit of a lad and is quite popular with the ladies. So he's constantly trying to find ways to evade his responsibilities. And he and his brother constantly have massive fights. And every fight they have, Siegfried sacks him and like kicks him out.
From his unpaid labour.
Well, no, from his role as his brother.
Oh. Yeah. That's really funny.
My favourite Tristan moment ever is when he goes out on a bell ringer's outing, which I think is just like a local piss up. And then the following morning, Siegfried comes down and he's like, Tristan's not back, his bed's not been slept in. And Jim's like, oh, maybe he stayed over with someone, whatever. And James goes out to his car to start his day's work. And Tristan is asleep in his car and he's been sick all over the passenger seat and he's just like sprawled on the steering wheel.
One thing that I get from watching these like older series is just how like structurally and stylistically different they are from TV that we watch now. I noticed in this that things will happen in a way that you would expect them to be like a Chekhov's gun in normal TV. So like there'll be a very short conversation about who's paying for the beers and it just goes nowhere. They just put that in. There's like something to be there in the... Yeah. And so that's really weird to me watching and seeing like people come in with the sides every now and then, or like, you know, a camera will linger on something ominously in a way that if you were watching like like Midsommar Murders today, you would know exactly why that was going to reappear and when. And there's just none of that in this. It's like quite leisurely and quite sort of scatty in a way that's quite appealing.
The shots are also a lot longer as well, so quite
really long
in a way that you would never get in a sort of countryside based TV program now. They'll just like film a road for a few seconds and you'll be like, is a car going to emerge on this road?
No.
Why are we doing this?
And there's like a panorama of like the landscape. There's lots of sort of bits where our new young vet like breathes deeply and looks out over the landscape, and then you get this like long panorama of like some fuzzy hills. You're like, okay. I mean, they look all right, I guess. Whereas like today there would be like, I don't know, some ridiculous CGI to try and really make it pack a punch, and it would still not last that long. So yeah, it's completely different to anything that I would watch now. It's extremely quaint.
Yeah.
And it was quite relaxing to watch right now.
Well, I'm glad you liked it. What are you going to recommend for me next time?
So next time, I thought we could talk about a film that I saw a little while ago when I was interviewing Sian Heder. And the film stars Alison Janney and Ellen Page, who you will remember from Juno, of course. Great co-stars in that movie. And it's about a girl called Tallulah who is basically having one of those moments in her life where she doesn't know what she's doing. She gets dumped, and she, when she goes looking for her recent ex-boyfriend, she finds a baby who is in a state of neglect. And it all unfolds from there, and Alison Janney gets involved. And it's really interesting, and it's quite weird. There's some elements at the beginning and end which make this film quite strange. So I'll be very interested to hear what you think about it.
I look forward to it. I'm a big fan of those two together and on screen.
Thanks for listening to Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to Seriously. All you have to do is search SRSLY in iTunes or any other podcasting app you use. While you're there, it would be really great if you could leave us an iTunes.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Review as it helps other people find the show.
We also rely on you listeners for your recommendations. So if you want to tell us what you thought about something, or if you've got something we should watch, you can contact us on Twitter, Facebook, via email. All the details are on seriouslypodcast.com. If you like, you can also recommend us to your friends, family, neighbours, strangers. Let them know that you like the podcast and they should be listening to it too.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit DiscoverSouthCarolina.com. This time you did something for the first.